people are just gonna respond differently. You know, what works for one person like isn't gonna work for another person. So like, I find myself like explaining things different ways. I find myself pointing different things out. You know, it's not one size fits all. People need like very different approaches.
Adolescence is a time for growth and big changes to the body, social development, and especially mentality. So for this episode today, we cannot wait to dive deeper into mental health. I am Daniela, your co-host, sitting here with Kira.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kira Yakubov, founder and lead therapist of Heal Your Roots Wellness. And I'm so excited to invite Emily Treadgold-Shaw today. She is a nurse practitioner in psychiatry. She's currently practicing at Integrative Psychiatry of Manhattan. And she happens to be a good friend of mine as well. So Emily, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Of course. So I first want to ask, what got you into therapy and to becoming a nurse practitioner into mental health field?
So it's funny. I knew that I wanted to do this from sort of an abnormally young age. I can remember being 15 and telling one of my friends that I wanted to be a child psychiatrist. And they said, well, that's a long way off. but it's funny. Other people were really good at other things. And what I was really good at was talking to people about their problems and helping them like sort through it. Mm-hmm. And I found out like, oh, like people get paid for this. Like somebody can pay me money to just talk people through their problems and help them. So I studied psychology in college and then I graduated into the recession. So I went straight to grad school and I decided to become a nurse practitioner because I wanted to be able to prescribe medication, but I also really wanted to be able to do psychotherapy. I think that's really important to be able to do both. And I really wanted to do both. I didn't want to lose that talk therapy mm-hmm. side. And I also really wanted the flexibility of being able to prescribe when needed. So so that's sort of how I got into it. I lasered in on it at a young age. But I decided, you know, I just kind of like kept going straight through with that. I had a really hard time when I was a teenager mm-hmm. and I had a lot of protective factors. So my parents were really great. They loved each other. They were very respectful. They were respectful and honest with me and my brother. It was a lot of warmth and kindness. Mm-hmm. And I was still like really struggling. Mm-hmm. So I also really wanted to help kids that might not have come from the same kind of really supportive family of origin that had, you know, that had more challenges than I had and were really struggling with those.
Yeah. I love that. I did not know I wanted to be a therapist when I was younger. I mean, I did subconsciously, but from my background, my parents were like, oh, you should go to accounting because that's a stable job for a woman. So I love that you actually always wanted to do that, specifically working with kids.
Yeah.
Now, let me ask, what were you guys like as a teenager? Because I know for myself, I was very rebellious. I was a good student. So in my mind, it was like, because I'm a good student, I should be allowed to come in when I want. And, you know, so I was rebellious in that sense, but I was very hardworking, very, like, very disciplined in terms of, like, if my mom asked me to do something, you know, things like that, helpful. But when it came to, like, wanting my freedom, that was like, oh, I'm owed this because I'm, look at me, I'm doing so well in school, you know? Mm-hmm. But I understand now as an adult that it probably drove my parents through the wall with nervousness, you know? So that was me as a teen and juggling a lot. And I really think I should have been seeing a therapist for sure. And not just because I was like, had that rebellious side, but because I did struggle a lot with like depression and not understanding it. I had a lot of insecurities and, you know, kind of get pushed aside as like, I'm shy, but really like I'm dealing with all these emotions and thoughts in my head that aren't healthy. So, so with that said, that was like me in a nutshell as a teenager, but what about you two?
So I was the opposite of rebellious. I was also shy, but I was very, like, I really wanted to get good grades. I, like, really wanted to, like, please everybody. I wanted to please my teachers. I wanted to please my parents. And my parents were not that strict. They were really honest with us. They grew up in, like, the 70s. Like, they were really, really, really honest with us about the stuff that they were doing. I did not do any of those things in college. I was also struggling with depression and didn't know it. It was also You know, and it's so sad to me now. If I had asked my parents to go to therapy, I'm sure they would have said yes. Mm-hmm. I just, like, I didn't know that I was depressed. I just thought that everybody was sad all the time. And I ended up talking a lot of my friends. I'm an oldest daughter, and a lot of my friends are also oldest daughters. And we sort of just ended up talking about it amongst ourselves and, like, trying to support each other. And then being like, well, we can't tell our parents. Mm-hmm. Like, then they would be worried. And it's so sad to me now, because, like, that didn't come, like, for me, that didn't come from my parents. Like, I'm sure if I had ever gone to my parents with a problem, they would have helped me. It was just that, like, I didn't want them to know I was struggling. And I wish that there had been, like, someone that had been able to be like, it's okay to ask for help.
Yeah.
So I think that's why I was really drawn to the field. Like, I really, even at the time, like, even when I was 15, I was like, with no insight, I was like, I want to be a child psychiatrist. Like, I wonder why I had that thought. It was, you know, I wished that someone could help me, but, like, didn't think that there was, like, the avenue for that just didn't exist in my head. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is going to be a sad girl club, because I was also very depressed and anxious growing up. I mean, there was, like, a before and after. Like, as a younger kid, I was very outgoing. I wanted to be an actress. I wanted to be, like, center of attention. Loved it until it was, like, approaching adolescence, when I had, like, facial hair and my body was changing, and I was like, oh, I want to be hidden from everybody, because if they can't see me, they can't make fun of me. And I'm just going to be, like, the funny kid in the back, like the class clown. So that was, like, my way of coping through that. But I had very strict parents. So, like, Danielle, he was immigrated here from Azerbaijan, Eastern Europe, and they did not understand sleepovers. They did not understand really, like, being sad, because we came to America and there was, like, no war currently happening. So that was, I had everything I needed. So I didn't have a good enough reason for them to understand why I'm sad or anxious. And I was really shy too. And I think the way that I dealt with that was, okay, like, if my parents aren't going to let me do this, how can I problem solve and, like, finagle a way to still get what I want, which is, like, in social settings? So, like, I would sneak out, or I don't know for listeners who are around our age, but caller ID and three-way calling.
Oh, yeah.
I told this to my parents later on in life, but I would say I'm, like, sleeping somewhere. I would say I'm sleeping at a friend's house, where really I'd be sleeping somewhere else. And then I would, like, call my friend, and then they would call my parents' house, and the caller ID would show up. So it would, I found ways around it, and I was also very rebellious. But I journaled a lot, or talked to my friends about being sad, or just read a lot of vampire books.
And that this is new that I learned about you.
Yeah.
But it was something that you turned to help manage it.
Yeah.
It was your thing too. It was, like, your personal thing that you loved. You brought up something that comes to mind now, because you mentioned about being the oldest. I know you're the only daughter. Mm-hmm. And now, while my parents were also immigrants, I do you feel I got a lot of freedom? I'm also the fourth and baby of my family. So what is your perspective? And I'll ask Emily first. What's your perspective with birth order and what happens to our mental state or our emotional side?
Yeah, there's definitely, I feel like there's this stereotype of the oldest child having to feel like they're really responsible. And I definitely felt like I fit that to a T. Like, other people's parents or my friends' parents or my parents' friends would be like, oh, you're so mature, you're so responsible. And I feel like that's sort of the stereotype of, like, the oldest child, like, having, and I have one brother. But I felt very like I had to have everything under control. And not because anybody told me that, but I feel like oldest children are sort of just, like, socialized to be, like, hyper responsible.
Mm-hmm. And then, Kiara, what did you experience with that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the youngest of three, and the girl, I have two older brothers, and my oldest brother definitely fit that bill. he was very parentified out of necessity. Like, we came to America, my parents didn't speak English. He was, like, seven, so he went everywhere with them to translate, to set things up. I mean, like, adult things to do. So he definitely took on that role. And then I have a middle brother, and then I'm the youngest, and I was definitely treated like the baby. And I think birth order does make a difference within family dynamics for sure. And even though you grow up in the same family, in the same house, everyone has a different experience and everyone's treated a little bit differently based on the birth order, your gender, different things that are going on with you, whether it's like personality or medically, or just like your relationship with each parent is different. So I think all these factors definitely play into mental health.
Absolutely. Because with me mentioning being the youngest of four, I was also born a few years later. So I do feel taken care of a lot, but at the same time, and my mom worked two jobs at times, my dad worked full-time job. So I did find myself being responsible, which if my mom ever listens to this, she's going to maybe laugh when I say this, but she feels bad about it. She's like, I feel like, you know, I wasn't able to be there, but she totally was. Mm-hmm. I think in me a little bit was like, I need things a certain way. And you mentioned earlier, Emily, about control. And I wonder if that played into like subconsciously, because I was anxious and had all these other feelings, I needed that sense of control for myself, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I also had to be very responsible at times because I was a few years behind my sisters. And so it was almost like I got the attention of, I feel like, a first child at times. So, so it's such an interesting aspect. And I ask that because I know you talk to a lot of family members here, and then Emily working a lot with teens.
So Emily, I'd love to hear what you enjoy the most about working with, whether it's adolescents or teens, and maybe some of the parts that are the toughest.
Yeah, I love adolescents because they're just discovering everything for the first time. There's this sense a lot of times, like when they're doing well, there's this sense of possibility. There's this sense of like, I could be anything or do anything, and I'm just discovering what I like. There's also adolescents will keep you on their toes. They will just be like, you don't really know what you're doing, do you? You really have to be, you can't try to finesse a kid that much. Like, they will see you like right through you. Like, you really have to be, at least like I find that I have to really be honest, and that like, I like that they keep me on my toes like that. But it is really challenging. You know, the challenging thing about working with kids is like, you have to, you know, you're also working with parents. A lot of times you're also working with the school counselor. A lot of times you're also working with the teachers, tutors. There's just a lot more people that you're communicating with, which is great because when you get a really great treatment team coalescing around a kid, that's really rewarding. But it's also, you know, you're coordinating all these moving parts, and sometimes the parents aren't getting along, and sometimes they're getting divorced, and sometimes, you know, they have different ideas about what the treatment plan should look like. And it's also, you know, it's hard because kids have very limited control over their environment. And a lot of times if they're in a really tough spot, that's very hard.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you always, and I had to like learn to like put like boundaries up and, you know, like learn not to take work home, but it's like, you wish that there was so much more that you can do and you just can't do that much. And with an adult, I feel like sometimes it's a little bit easier because like kids, they really can't change their circumstances a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And that's really challenging.
So I worked at a high school as an adolescent counselor.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, it was not my favorite.
Okay, fair.
It was not my favorite position. And I also had to like reach out to like their individual therapists and things like that. And one of the things that was tough for me that I think is different than when working with adults is kids, they didn't always want to see me, but they had to see me, or it was part of their treatment plan that their parents and teachers decided for them. And so I would have kids come down like, yeah, I don't want to talk to you. Like, this is super dumb. I don't know. I don't care about you. And we would sit there, and sometimes it'd be like pulling teeth, and I understand why from their perspective. And from my perspective, I'm like, it's not always, for me personally, it just didn't feel rewarding or helpful because I'm like, I feel like I'm forcing someone to talk to me. And like, as a person, I hate feeling like I am forcing anything. I always want people to come like voluntarily. So that was the toughest part for me working with kids.
That's really hard. I have that a lot. And I've had it a lot also. I've worked at all kinds of places, and I've worked at an inpatient unit for adolescents also, where they definitely didn't want to be there.
Yeah.
So that's really hard. I think that's one of the things I find more rewarding, because sometimes you start out with a really tough kid and they're like, this is stupid. I've been to therapy before and it doesn't work. You know, I don't want to be here. I'm only here because my parents are making me. And I'm like, okay, great. Do you like to play Uno? You know, and I always am like, you know, look, you don't have to stay. My first ever therapy client when I was in school was a 13-year-old girl that would not talk to me. Like, not a word. Wow. Like, she would, like, look away from me.
Yeah.
And we, like, would just play games. Mm-hmm. And eventually she warmed up a little bit. And I also, like, I didn't think, of course, I'm, like, in school, I'm freaking out. I'm like, I'm not helping this person at all. Like, I'm definitely failing at this. Oh. Like, this was such a terrible idea. And it actually, like, that is now what I find, like, something, like, really rewarding is when kids don't want to talk to you. And then eventually, like, if you don't push, you know, you gotta, like, mm-hmm. you gotta kind of give them enough space. But, like, eventually, like, when they start confiding in you, like, that's really, like, that's also, like, extremely rewarding. Yeah, but it doesn't always happen like that. Like, sometimes kids are just like, I don't want to be here. And that's hard. Yeah. It's easier for me now because, now that I'm in private practice, I have, like, so much longer that I can work with the same family. That's actually, like, one of the reasons why I switched from working in. I loved working in hospitals, but it's one of the reasons that I switched to, I wanted to see kids longer term. I really wanted to see them, like, evolve.
Aww.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by seeing them longer? Like, the duration, was it different when you're seeing them from the hospital or counselor?
Yeah. So when I worked in hospitals, unfortunately, because of the way that insurance is structured now, a lot of times when you go to an inpatient hospitalization as a teenager, or even as an adult, you know, it's like a 7 to 10 day hospitalization before the insurance company is like, so it's hard, you know, somebody can improve a lot in a short amount of time, but what I really like is seeing that long-term improvement over, like, weeks and months. And, like, some of my patients now I've had for years. Yeah. So I ended up you know, and a lot of people transition. Like, it's really good to work at a hospital right out of school because you just, like, you see, I learned so much. You see a ton of stuff. But I ended up, you know, but it's also really hard. It's like kids in really difficult circumstances. And I just, after a while, I just couldn't do it anymore. Yeah. So it is, you know, it has been really nice to work with kids longer term.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious of, I know with kids, especially younger, it's like being able to play and do games and stuff. How do you feel like that has changed with COVID and having kids completely remote?
So I actually was in person the whole pandemic. When the pandemic hit, I was working at a public hospital in the city and we went to all phone and that was really hard. Wow. And then the job that I had after that, I was actually in person. And then now I'm in person. I was in person 2 days a week before I got pregnant. If you're just listening and not watching the video, I am 7 months pregnant and enormous.
And gorgeous.
Exactly.
Before I got pregnant, I was going in 2 days a week, home 3 days a week. Now I'm going in 1 day a week. Gotcha. But I usually, like, reserve my in-person slots for, like, younger kids. I have a couple, like, 11, 12, 13-year-olds. Okay. So I try, it's just harder, you know, it's harder. Some kids are great with technology. Mm-hmm. Some kids, like, transitioned, like, right away. They were like, you know, it was totally fine. We, like, play drawing games and stuff like that. But it was really hard, to transition, especially, like, at the beginning, to transition from, like, seeing kids in my office and being able to play with them to, like, doing it all, like, all over the phone. That was really challenging. Being like the flexibility of being able to work from home, but I also, like, when I see kids, I really like being in the room with them.
The phone sounds so challenging just to keep an adult's focus. I would imagine or teenager, an adolescent in that sense. But yeah, that I commend you for that, because that sounds like that was a lot of extra possibly in your approaches for you.
Yeah, it was just, it's just harder to keep people engaged.
Yeah,
like, there's no way. You know, if you can't see them, like, there's no way to be like, you're watching TV right now. Like, oh, you are. So it's, yeah. So that was challenging. Oh, the kids adapted to it really well. I was really impressed the pandemic has precipitated, like, a huge, like, adolescent mental health crisis that was there, totally there before, but just, like, sort of, like, laid bare the adolescent mental health crisis that we were already having.
Yeah.
But I was actually really impressed with how resilient the kids that I worked with were and how, like, well they adapted.
So you're mentioning about the phone and you mentioned about technology. My question to you is, how do you see, or what is your perspective on the fact that social media now plays a part with teens? In my opinion, I like the fact that people can learn about mental health. I feel like the awareness is heavy. It could just be who I follow, but I'm hoping that it comes across to teens as well. but I also see a downside to it. So what's your, both of you, we'll start with Emily, but what's your perspective?
Yeah, so there's so much good and bad. I see so many teens using it in such a creative way to express themselves. And also, honestly, a couple of my young adult patients have seen things on social media, either like about ADHD or about like complex PTSD, where they're like, oh wow, I really relate to these symptoms. And then we talk about it. And that's like why they came to therapy. That's awesome. I have also had a lot of like early adolescent girls be like, I have borderline personality disorder. And me being like, no, you definitely don't. Like, I know that you saw a list of symptoms, but that doesn't mean
this is just regular teen.
So. Yeah, exactly.
I'm raising my hand because as an adult, I've also done that to my therapist.
Yeah, like, no, totally.
I was reading about schizophrenia and I think I am schizophrenic. And she was like, no, not based on my perspective.
Yeah. So I think that like, as long as you have a person that you can talk to about it, that's great. But that it's very easy for me to see how you could like read a list of symptoms that you relate to because you were not the developmental like age target of the symptoms. And you could think that you have, like, you could sort of like label yourself with this thing where you're like, oh my God. And it turns out to not really be accurate for you. So I'm glad that there's so much more like awareness and information. And I think that kids do feel so empowered to talk about their own mental health struggles in a way now that like they never did, even when we were kids, which I think is amazing. But I also, you know, it's funny because I've been thinking about this a lot because I'm about to become a mom. So my husband and I were laughing that, you know, when we talk about the baby, I'm going to be like, no screens till you're 40. I'm so worried. You know, I'm so glad that I didn't have social media as a child. So like I got Facebook for the first time when I was 16, but it didn't even have the newsfeed back then. It was like super like, it was like a really, really early version. There was no infinite scroll. There was none of the things now that sort of where they've engineered to make it like hit the dopamine part of your brain that makes you want to do it more. And then Instagram didn't come out until I was in grad school, I think. And I'm so glad. Like that's like, I sort of like think all the time about how like grateful I am that I didn't have Instagram or TikTok when I was in high school. And that makes me really sad because I definitely see a lot of the, you know, girls that I work with, but also boys, also like even like adult men like really struggle with their body image. And I really struggled with my body image in high school and college, without any of those things.
Yeah.
So like I've seen girls really struggle. I've seen boys really struggle. There's like this pressure to, you know, there's all these like bodybuilder Instagrams and like, even just, you know, it's like, you have to keep in mind that you're just seeing like a very like curated, like very like, you know, nobody is posting their bad angles or their bad days. And you're just, I feel like people feel really inadequate. And then it also with the, you know, with things like infinite scroll, like it's so hard to, and even like, I find it really hard to tear myself away from my phone. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't use social media at all. Like I'm really, that was like a boundary that I had to set for myself because I was like, oh, like I am like having trouble like putting this down. So like as an adult, I had to be like this, like, I don't need this to be part of my life.
Yeah.
And like, it's fine because it's not the primary way that my close friends communicate with each other. But if you're a teenager, you know, I could never say to one of my adolescent patients, like, okay, well, why don't you just not use TikTok?
Yeah.
Like, it's not realistic, you know? So I have to talk to them about like meeting, you know, I just sort of meet them where they are. And you know, parents are freaking out and have to be like, you know, especially like also with like video games during the pandemic, a lot of the boys and girls that I work with were playing a lot of online games with their friends and parents would be really upset because, you know, and I had to be like, look, like they're not in school. Like they can't see their friends.
Yeah.
Like this is like the time that they have to like relax and like chat with them, like the way that you talk to your friends.
Yeah.
And I don't think they should be doing it 12 hours a day. You know, it's okay to put limits on it, but I think that it would be really hard for them to go without any social communication. Like that is also not good. So it's about striking a balance, but striking a balance with these things is so difficult. It's difficult for adults. So it's like kids have no, you know, your prefrontal cortex doesn't finish developing until you're 26. So it's like it's really hard to like self-regulate your like social media and video game use when you were an adolescent. So it's difficult. And also a lot of the tools that parents use to limit their kids' social media use. The kids that I work with are very like tech savvy, and they usually just get around it. And I mean, like when we were kids, even there was some of that.
Yeah.
Like I remember like going through a VPN at the school library so that I could like play nerdy word games that we were playing. This is like how much rebelling I was doing. It was like playing text quiz in the library through a VPN. Big nerd, you guys. But I, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is like parents are like, oh, we have parental controls on the TV. And I'm like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Sorry. Sorry, but your kid knows how to get around them. It has been getting around them for 2 years. I know he's 10.
So I don't work with kids now at all. But when I did, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. Like, they, if there's a will, there's a way. And like, they, I learned so many different apps they would use to communicate with each other, to figure things out. Parents would never have a clue. And like, you wouldn't know unless you're a kid or you're like figuring that stuff out. I can definitely see how parents might think that they have certain controls or they know what's what their kids are watching or doing. And unfortunately, they may not, or be underestimating their ability to do what they want to do and be able to communicate with their friends. And I'm also very glad that I did not grow up with social media. I mean, we had MySpace when I was in high school.
That's crazy.
And texting was like a hot mess. Like you had to hit the same button like 3 times to get it. So it wasn't really a lot of texting. There was the AOL and AIM.
I was thinking AOL.
Yeah.
We used to think crack codes for people's passwords. That's how we spent our time trying to hack.
AIM is how I learned to type 100 words a minute.
Yeah.
So definitely wouldn't have achieved that without Instagram. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. A little bit like shifting gears. So you're a nurse practitioner in psychiatry. So not a lot of people know the difference between a nurse practitioner, okay, a psychiatrist, a therapist, someone who can do all the things. So if you would be able to kind of share a little bit about the differences, that'd be great.
Yeah, okay. I have this conversation with people all the time. So a psychiatrist is a medical doctor that can prescribe medication, and then sometimes they also do psychotherapy. They're licensed to do both. Mm-hmm. A lot of psychiatrists only prescribe because of the way that insurance is structured, but some do psychotherapy. So I'm a nurse practitioner in psychiatry, which means I got a nursing degree I have 2 bachelor's degrees because it took a little longer. So I have a bachelor's in psychology, which you don't need if you want to be a nurse practitioner, but I happen to have 2 bachelor's degrees. So I went back and I got a 2nd bachelor's in nursing, and then I got a master's in psychiatric nursing. So I'm licensed to prescribe and do psychotherapy as well. The privileges for nurse practitioners are different state to state. Where I'm licensed in New York, I basically can do almost everything that a psychiatrist can do. So you have to have a supervising position for 2 years of full-time work, the equivalent of 2 years of full-time work in New York, and then you can practice independently, which is what I do now. But I used to work in Louisiana, and then I would have to still have a collaborating position if I were still living there. So it's a little bit different state to state, like how much supervision you need and what you're allowed to do. But in New York, the parity is pretty good. So I'm really like allowed to practice pretty much like the full extent of my license, which is great. And then, a psychologist is usually someone that has a PhD in either clinical psychology or there are different kinds. But in most states, those people can't prescribe, but in some states have prescribing psychologists where you finish your psychology degree and then you do like a shorter pharmacology degree. That's new.
Yeah,
and it is like, I think gaining momentum in some places. There's a huge shortage of psychiatric providers. Mm-hmm. And especially for kids. So I was sort of like, whatever we can do to improve access is really good. As long as the training is adequate, I'm like very into like improving access. And then there are therapists that are trained as licensed clinical social workers. There are like a lot of different ways of becoming a therapist. But psychiatrists and nurse practitioners and some psychologists can prescribe.
Gotcha. Yeah. So licensed therapists like myself, cannot prescribe medication. And so it's really great for us to have great connections with nurse practitioners or psychiatrists so we can work together to help clients. And I'm also wondering, so in the moment, do you see clients only for med management and not therapy, or do you normally do both?
I try to do both. I have a couple clients now that are only therapy. Mm-hmm. And then I have a lot of clients where I do both, and some clients that I only do medication management, but usually if they already have an individual therapist.
Okay.
So usually sometimes people will see a therapist for a while, and then their therapist will say, you know, I feel like maybe you should talk to a psychiatrist or a prescribing practitioner. So most of my patients that just do medicine, that I just do medication management with, already have a therapist. And then patients that don't, I will usually do some amount of therapy with them. And then especially a lot of my child adolescent patients, a lot of them are not on medication. Some are, but some are not. Some of them I'm just doing psychotherapy.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, it's just so fascinating. What's the range of diagnoses, I guess it would be called? Mm-hmm. What is that range that you see?
So I do a lot of stuff right now in the practice that I work in. I'm seeing a lot. It's a lot of ADHD, a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression, a lot of, some like obsessive compulsive, like PTSD. I have some patients that, have psychotic disorders. Not as many as when I was working in hospitals, just because like the population is a little bit different. I also like really enjoy working with patients that are working on like trying to heal from substance abuse. So that's mostly my adult patients. But I see a lot of that as well. Mm. Yeah.
And so I'm curious for listeners out there, for parents, because I know some parents might feel nervous to have their kids start medication. Other parents are all for it. What has been your experience with working with parents, especially when they're under 18 who are bringing their kids in?
Yeah, a lot of parents are really hesitant, and I totally understand that. Like, you just want to do what's best for your kid. A lot of parents are like, what if they become addicted to drugs because of this? A lot of parents are like, what if they can't stop taking the medication? I think there's a lot of nervousness about like setting them on a path that they're afraid they're not going to be able to control kind of like where that goes next. And these medications have risks. Like, it's not something that I would do lightly. Like, a lot of my child and adolescent patients are not on medication. I certainly like want to always try everything else first. There are a couple things. So like, for instance, like with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, there's not a lot you can do with just psychotherapy. Yeah. Like, the medications for that are really helpful, and they have the potential to really improve like a lot of kids' lives. Mm-hmm. But I totally understand like parents' hesitancy, and you hear a lot of horror stories on the internet about ADHD medication, and some of that is, you know, there are like real risks. So from a personal perspective, like, I wish that I had had medication. I take medication for depression now, and I wish that I had been able to take it earlier. I got diagnosed when I was 27. I feel like I could have avoided some of the things that happened to me before that if I had been diagnosed earlier. I mean, obviously, like, everything, I'm glad, you know, I am happy with the way that everything turned out in my life.
Sure.
But from a personal perspective, a lot of times I think you can alleviate a lot of harm. You know, if you were in pain, like physical pain, like if you broke your arm or your leg, like the analogy that I use a lot with parents is, especially parents that have kids that have ADHD and don't want to start medication. You know, I say it's a little bit like if your child needed glasses and you were saying that they just needed to try harder to see better.
Wow.
Like, it's not possible. And they're not lazy. They're not a bad kid. Like, they're trying as hard as they can. They just, you know, their neurochemistry is like different than other kids. And without the medication, it's going to be really hard for them to perform up to their potential. And a lot of times, like, kids are losing self-esteem. They're like, I'm dumb. Like, I can't get this. Why is everybody else getting this? They're getting in trouble. They're like, I'm a bad kid. So like, that's like really when I'm like, look, like, we could really prevent like a not so great outcome in the future by starting medication now. Also, if you're unmedicated for ADHD, your risk factors go up for other, like for car accidents, for like substance abuse, for depression and anxiety. So I really like, this is something that I really try to emphasize to parents when I talk to them, that like, I know it seems really intimidating and scary and frightening to start medication for your child, but a lot of times it's like, if it's preventing them from like repeating a grade or preventing them from dropping out of high school or preventing them from being like unemployed or underemployed, like really like the benefits outweigh the risks in so many situations.
I wish that you existed. Well, you did exist. But when I was a kid with my parents, and like as immigrants, especially from where we come from, mental health is like not a thing that you really are concerned with or understand. And so I was diagnosed with ADHD in attentive type as an adult. And like as a kid, it wasn't detected because I wasn't hyperactive. I wasn't bad in class. I wasn't disruptive. I would just daydream. My head would be out the window. I wouldn't know what the teacher's saying. I would hear, I would forget. And then it would make me feel like I'm dumb or I'm lazy. And then I did develop depression and anxiety. And I can't imagine if I would have told my parents back then, they would have done much, not because they don't care. I don't think that they even recognized that there was like resources like that for me. And they definitely would not have put me on medication. Like even now as an adult, I was like concerned, like, do I take it? Do I not? What is it going to do to me? Like all the same stuff. And I can see the benefits of taking it and the huge difference. And if I was in school when I was younger taking medication, I mean, I don't know how they would have turned out. I'm happy with my life now, but I think it would have decreased a lot of the struggling that I went through and a lot of like the insecurities that I experienced.
Absolutely. And hearing when you say, like, as someone who wants to be a future parent, but also it recognizes a few things, right? So I recognize that for myself, I love the all natural approach, right? And I also take medicine for my depression. So I also recognize the benefit of medicine because I had to be explained that this had to be explained to me several times by my doctor, by my therapist of, well, you know, I always got the diabetes, you know, the diabetes example. If you had diabetes, you would have to take medicine, right? So you wouldn't just not take it and suffer, right? And while you're taking it, you can also do things in your lifestyle to help it, right? So there's also, the dependency doesn't have to be there either. Eventually, there's ways to work past it. But right now, you know, right in those moments, it was really helpful to recognize that effect. Mm-hmm. And so all these things considered, for me, myself, one day when I want to become a parent, hearing you say, Emily, that like you don't take it lightly, and then hearing both accounts, and I feel similar in the sense of like as a child, I do recognize that like there could have been a lot of help seeking a therapist, possibly the medicine too. So hearing all this and then hearing on top of that, like you don't take this lightly to diagnose the medicine, gives me so much comfort. And I just want to put that out there for people, because in case we do have listeners who are parents, or, you know, there are teens and they want their teens to listen because maybe the teen's not comfortable with it, right? They can know that it's not just something that's like, we are dismissing you. We don't care about you. Here, pop this pill or whatever you have to do to feel better. Like, it's not a dismissal. It's actually a very well thought out process.
And I also want to say, I hear this a lot with adults because I work with adults, is I can even like go through this and explain this and they intellectually understand. And there's like this narrative or belief, like, well, then it means I'm weak, or it means that I can't just do this on my own. Like there's something wrong with me. I should be able to just figure it out, suck it up, do better. And it's like, it's not about motivation. I mean, like part of it, right? But like you said, it's like the brain chemistry. We can't will our way out of brain chemistry. That's just the physiological part of our brain. And I think part of it is the acceptance and working through that shame that like, it's okay if you rely on this thing. Like that's, I mean, think about like, what do we do every day? Like the glasses thing was a great example too. Or if someone, like if there's a disability or if they need a cane or if there's not, like if it improves your life, it's not a negative thing and it's not a sign of weakness. It means that actually, I think it means you're pretty courageous to accept all the resources available to you so you can be your best self.
Yeah, I didn't have that much insight about it in myself, even when I became a nurse practitioner in 2014. And it wasn't until 2017 that I started medication. Mm-hmm. So even though I remember really vividly, I was in graduate school and I was reading a questionnaire for depression that I was giving to adolescents as I was doing an intake for one of my clinicals. And I think it was I remember that I was reading these questions like, I feel like a failure. I feel like I'm being punished. I feel like I don't look as good as I used to. And I was like, oh no. Because I was, you know, I was really burnt out and I was really struggling. Yeah. And it was still like literally like years later, I was seeing this amazing therapist in New Orleans when I was living down there. And she eventually, you know, she brought it up to me a couple times. She tried to be really gentle. She was like, have you ever thought about this? I was like, no. And even though I was in the field and even though I should have theoretically been able to recognize all the signs, like it was, she finally had to be like, go to a psychiatrist. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Like, I don't want to see you again until you talk to someone that can prescribe medication. Yeah. And then once I started it, I was like, oh, like, this is how other people function and like have been like managing to do things like my entire life. Mm-hmm. I like couldn't have this. Sometimes people, you know, there's that saying that doctors make the worst patients. Mm. And it's like, sometimes like even though you're in the field, even though you know everything, theoretically should be able to know everything. Like I couldn't like make the connection. It's like, you just have this huge blind spot when it's yourself. That's why also a lot of my friends and people I know were really hesitant to get into therapy because they were like, well, I've read a lot about this. Like, I don't think there's anything that like, I couldn't already like find out for myself. And I'm like, no, like you can't see yourself clearly. You need someone else to talk to be able sometimes to sort it out for you and to switch your perspective on it. And that, you know, I'm so grateful that that happened. And I'm so grateful that I finally accepted help. But it's funny, like it was hard for me to ask for it even as an adult.
I can totally relate to that and in so many ways. And it was actually that moment of, for me, as you mentioned, how people are like, well, I can fix it myself. I've been fixing things my whole life, you know, very independent. And what would happen is I would turn to my friends and family. And I started because guilt actually helped me in this sense, because I started to feel like they were no longer able to know how to help me. Like they would, multiple times I had people say to me at my worst moments when things were just, I could not cope and I was turning to them, they would say, I don't know how to help you anymore. Right. And so then it was like, oh, you know, like I couldn't help myself. I was putting this, you know, I say burden, we're not a burden on our support system, but I felt like a burden on my friends and family, to the point where they're like, we don't know how to help you. Like I will sit with you. I don't know how to help you anymore. And that was like, my guilt kind of kicked in for putting that on them. But also it was a good little kick in the tush of like, there are professionals for everything, including what I'm going through. And you know, I gotta just be brave and do it again. And this was like an again situation, right? Because I had started therapy when I was 24. It was like the year or two after college. Mm-hmm. And which I feel is like if I had to pick an area to like really dive into, is like that transition period. I just feel like there's so much there, but I felt that confusion at that time. And so I had been in therapy for a long time and then I stopped because I felt good. Mm-hmm. But then I let myself go years before starting again, and it had to be all these things. But you know, as we mentioned, I can fix myself, I can do it, I can do it, I can apply this, which we can. Mm-hmm. But now with all I know with mental health and the work that I do talking with therapists and things like that, I know that that comes into play for management, right? And so yes, we have the capability to cope, to manage, to improve, but it's going to be so much deeper to work with somebody to really heal and really get the process going of changing your mind, changing the patterns and all of that.
And I appreciate both of you being so vulnerable and honest about this because it's true. I mean, even as a practitioner or a therapist, we, in air quotes, should know or should be able to diagnose, but we're still human beings, right? Like that's why we need an objective third party or, you know, someone outside of us in a relationship to point to things, to ask us questions, to look at things in a different way. And we don't have any stake in their decision besides wanting them to do well and having their best interests in mind. And so, like, yes, having a support system is extremely important, like having a community, and recognizing that your family and friends are going to be biased, and like, that's okay. And they're going to see things from their perspective through their lived experiences and what they think you should be doing based on what they think would make you happy. And it may not actually be what would make you happy. So, I mean, I started seeing a therapist once I went to college because of the university counseling center. I never went in high school. I never even thought about asking my parents. But as soon as I went to college, I was like, oh, it's free. Well, not free, right? You pay that tuition. And I'm still paying for it. But it's included. And so I would utilize that. And I saw a therapist throughout my entire time at Drexel. And then when I went to grad school, I saw a therapist there too. So it is extremely helpful for anyone and for therapists too. Like, we are not above having our emotions processed and analyzed and have a new perspective.
Yeah, when I was in graduate school, they actually were like, we can't make you be in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
We would. So they were very like, it is really important. You know, because especially in child and adolescent mental health, it's like you're absorbing all this stuff. A lot of it is really heavy. So I started going in grad school. But again, there were 10 free sessions as part of like the student like health insurance plan. So after that, and I graduated and I didn't go again until I think I was like 20, 21 then. And then I think I didn't go again until I was 24. I sort of like could have used it that whole time. Yeah, that actually, honestly, I'm grateful for that too, because that sort of gave me this like plausible deniability where I can be like, well, my school really recommended this. So, but I wish I had known that it was okay just to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite approach that you use?
Like a favorite therapeutic approach?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my training was very like psychodynamic psychotherapy oriented, which is a little bit like old school now. Yeah. But that's, I trained in New York City, and New York City is very like psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I fold in a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. I fold in like some dialectical behavioral therapy, which I really love actually. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just more supportive. But I would say that sort of like my training is psychodynamic, but it's not as suited to my personality. Mm-hmm. I tend to be a little more reactive, and like I like to give a lot of direct feedback. So a lot of my patients have said that they've been in therapy before, but the therapist just asked them questions or like didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And I had like a negative experience with a psychodynamic psychotherapist when I was younger. I've had therapists that train in all different like modalities, but I think that like anybody can be good in any modality and anybody can be bad in any modality. Sure. It doesn't really depends on the individual. But I'm just a lot more reactive. So I like to give a lot of direct feedback, and I'm really direct with my patients in a way that I think a lot of them really appreciate. Maybe some of them don't appreciate. But I think I tend to be a lot more direct than a lot of other psychodynamic psychotherapists. So I wouldn't say, I'm hesitant to call myself that, because I do tend to be a little more hands-on.
That's actually hilarious, because I was also trained in psychodynamic and I also give a lot of direct feedback.
Yeah.
I think our generation of therapists might be different from the old school ones, where we learned psychodynamic. We might have learned all these different modalities, and we kind of choose to pick and take what we think is helpful to incorporate and not stick solely to one only and do it exactly the way we were taught. Because psychodynamic, I love it. And for people listening that aren't a therapist or in the mental health field, know the jargon, it's really like processing and being analytical of what's going on underneath what you're presenting with or what you're experiencing, to get to like the root cause, and like observing and being reflective of like your coping mechanisms and how different family members and different dynamics in your life impact you and how you view the world. And so there is a lot of therapists like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, tell me more. and that's it. And the other person's like, okay, so like, what do I do with this information now? Yeah. So I love that you give the direct feedback too, because I think it's important just how we're having a conversation. Like, I think it's intimidating to just walk into a room and then the therapist is sitting in silence and like, you just have to start the session. Like, what is happening right now?
Yeah, and I think that sometimes, again, like, I've definitely given direct feedback that people were not ready to hear.
Sure.
So I, like, it's a learning curve. I mean, and I wish I could be like, I am perfect, and then every session I do the perfect thing for the patient.
Of course.
But I've definitely stepped in it before too. So it's a balance between, you know, you don't want to like just put a bunch of stuff on the patient that they're already here. Mm-hmm. But also it's, you know, when they like, it has to be their decision. They have to like, you know, rather than like cutting to the chase, like it's important for them to like come to the realization. But I think that it's also important, you know, if it's going to take them like 2 years and it's really messing up their life, like sometimes I'm a little more direct.
Yeah.
As the person who is not the therapist and on the receiving end, mm-hmm. I feel, I would say that I appreciate that so much because, and now I like to talk, right? I don't mind.
You do?
I do. It's actually funny. When I was younger, I didn't, right? So this is like a whole, as an adult, it's like mm-hmm. a whole new becoming for me, but I do. I like to talk. And at the same time, if I went into a session like, where, as you're mentioning, Kira, that the person's just waiting for you, I would be intimidated off the bat. And I can't even imagine for someone who already isn't like, comfortable about talking about their mental state. Like, I will tell you, like, you know, I'm happy to share if I'm having a crappy day. You will hear all more about it than you want to know. But, you know, so on this end, just so you both know, at least from my own opinion, I appreciate that so much. And what was actually funny is with my therapist, I started to recognize her facial expressions too. It's almost like I would say there was a directness, and then I would notice her expression at times, and I'd be like, go ahead. Just go ahead. You can say I'm ready for it. You can tell me.
Well, that's why really old school psychodynamic psychotherapists would make you lie on the couch, mm-hmm. so you can't see them react.
Yeah. Blank slate.
Yeah, and I did have a therapist like that once that did make me lie on the couch, probably because I was trying to make him laugh, and he knew, and he was like, "No, you can't, mm-hmm. like you gotta not be able to see me." Yeah, because I think I tend to use a lot of humor, like, to cope with stress. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you know, and that's, like, healthy in some ways and unhealthy in other ways. But I think that we started out face-to-face, and eventually he made me, like, lie on the couch. Because that's, like, traditionally why, like, that's, you know, it's, like, in the old school, in sort of, like, New Yorker cartoons of the therapist's office, where you're, like, lying on the couch and the therapist is behind you. That's originally why. It's so that you weren't trying to gauge the reaction.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
I just thought it was to make a comfortable setting. I hear you, though.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, what this reminds me of, too, and this is maybe a little bit of a digression, but learning a lot about EQ and leadership with someone else actually I'm working with on a podcast. And so they're talking a lot about leadership in it. And it's reminding me a lot of like situational leadership where you can adjust your approach to things within the moment of what happens. Mm-hmm. So with this idea of like situational leadership and adjusting to the scenario, I know you have the skills, right? You're both professionals, you're both trained, but have you experienced this moment where you have to really adjust to the situation and lean on maybe experiential skills or any type of other skills outside of what you've learned professionally?
I would say my whole job.
There's like never a dull moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, so for the EQ is emotional intelligence. I mean, that's really what we're doing the whole time. Is a lot of it is reading body language, which was kind of tough during the pandemic when we went all remote, because all you see from a person or a client is basically their neck or shoulders up, and you're missing so much other information that you'd be receiving. So yes, we have all this training, all these different methods and theories and techniques, and you really have to be able like to be in touch with your intuition and read body language and be able to feel what someone is experiencing or going through and how that may not be congruent to what they're saying. So So like someone might be telling a horrible traumatic story in their life and they're smiling and laughing. And so I take a moment to pause, like, did you notice that this is what your body's doing as you're sharing this? And so it is like every, I feel like all the sessions are situational for us to be able to like shift gears. Cause yes, we have a treatment plan and there's techniques and there's things that we want to do, but you can't prioritize, I don't know, for me at least, I can't prioritize this structure over what's happening right now in this moment with this person in front of me. What do you think, Emily?
Yeah, exactly. I would say at this point I rely a lot on my experience in terms of like what patients are going to respond to from my sense of what they're like.
Mm-hmm.
So I find like learning about the world and like when you're seeing something like that through a child's eyes, it's like you're getting to see it again for the first time. That's something that I'm really excited about. There's so many cool things about our roles and as an adult, you know, especially like I've had periods of time where I've worked a lot and gotten really like, you know, forgetting to stop and smell the roses. So I feel like having a kid makes you be so present in the moment. It just forces you to be like, no, like this is what's around us right now. And this is what we're going to talk about and notice and engage with. So I'm excited to be able to slow down.
Aww.
Yeah.
I love that.
Me too. That was beautiful. Like, can I come hang out?
Yeah. Come like, camping with us.
Yeah. I could use some presence in my life.
So I think we can kind of start to wrap it up. Emily, thank you so much for being on today. It was a blast. I'm glad you were able to join us. And I hope you can come on to future episodes.
Yeah, anytime. This was so great. Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to make sure that you can connect with Emily in our show notes. There will be a link to get in touch with her. But we will see you in 2 weeks. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Bye.
This is a Bivesta production.